Hello, and welcome to Behind the News, KPFA exclusive edition for May 3, 2008. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. My show on WBAI, where Behind the News originates, was preempted last Thursday, so rather than afflict you with a rerun, I've decided to produce a fresh one just for this morning. My guest today, Joel Covell, takes up most of the hour. Joel teaches at Bard College and is the editor of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. He's here to talk about the new edition of his book, The Enemy of Nature. The enemy is, no surprise here, capitalism. More about all that in a bit, but first some news. On Friday morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released its employment report for April. Though headline job loss of 20,000 was smaller than most people, including me, expected, much of the rest of the report looked gloomier than that surface number. Even the decline in the unemployment rate from 5.1% to 5.0% isn't as encouraging as it might seem. One reason things looked worse on closer inspection was that gains in a few sectors countered losses in many more. For example, losses in employment and construction and manufacturing together totaled more than 100,000, a large number. And the losses in construction weren't just in housing. Many came from non-residential building, including infrastructure, suggesting that the real estate bust is spreading into the commercial sector and that pressure on government budgets is making itself felt in cutbacks in public construction. Continuing a pattern of many months, the biggest gains were in healthcare, which is good news for those employed, but not such good news for medical inflation, and in bars and restaurants. Temp employment, which often leads broader trends, fell. And state and local employment was up only a quarter as much as it's averaged over the last year, further evidence of fiscal stress. And things might even be worse than they look. The numbers I've just been citing come from a survey of employers. But in normal times, business startups hire workers that are missed by the survey because the BLS doesn't know the employers exist. To compensate for that, the statisticians use a model that works pretty well most of the time. But when the economy is turning, it doesn't work so well because startups can become failures. I suspect we're in one of those times now. That model added 267,000 jobs in April. Without it, job losses would have come close to 300,000. A big number, but typical of recessions. Don't conclude from that the government is cooking the books. As I said, the model works well most of the time. It's only early in recessions that it can get way off. If anyone starts saying that the BLS is cooking the books, I'll come and personally horsewhip you, unless you enjoy that sort of thing, in which case I'll have to find a more appropriate punishment. Another detail from the survey of employers, average hourly wages were up just 0.1%, well behind inflation. Yearly wage gains are now lagging price increases, meaning that real wages are falling. There were some real wage gains last year, but those have been undone. In fact, aside from a few years in the late 1990s, which saw consistent gains, real wages have been stagnant or declining for 35 years. The cumulative effect of this is that the average hourly wage, adjusted for inflation, is back where it was in 1965. Besides a survey of employers, the government also does a survey of households, which is where the unemployment numbers come from. It asks people whether they're employed or not, and if they weren't working, if they were looking for work or not. That survey showed a rise in employment in contrast with the employer survey, but the composition of that increase was not encouraging. Almost all the new jobs went to workers aged 20 and under. Almost none went to so-called prime-age workers, those aged 25 to 54. Part-time employment, especially for those who want full-time work but could only find part-time, was up, and full-time employment was down. Some on Wall Street concluded from the report that the economy and the job market are stabilizing. But given all the internal blemishes I've been describing, it's hard to draw that kind of conclusion. Supporting my analysis is the sour and worsening public mood detected by pollsters. An example of that, earlier this week, the Pew Center reported that a majority of survey respondents, 56% of them, reported that they're either not moving ahead in life or falling backwards, whatever that means exactly, the worst result in half a century of polling. An economy providing lots of part-time jobs to the young and few full-time jobs to the prime-aged is one that could have a hard time sustaining life. It seems to me that the job market and the broader U.S. economy are eroding, but not collapsing. While erosion is probably better than outright collapse, it could go on for longer than many people expect. Okay, let's take a musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Joel Covell. That was the Ricercare, or Fugue, in six voices from Bach's musical offering, performed by David Jansen on the harpsichord. My guest this morning, Joel Covell, mentioned Bach in this interview we're about to hear, so I thought he'd make for some good musical interludes. Later on in the show, we'll hear what Anton Webern did with this piece in 1935, in the spirit of Joel's talking about going more deeply into music while treading lightly on the earth. I first came across Joel Covell's work back in the early 1980s when I was supposedly writing a dissertation on American poetry. I was trying to find some way to link psychoanalysis and culture, some connection between the individual mind and the broader society. A friend recommended Covell's book White Racism from the early 70s, and I was extremely impressed. He'd done just what I was looking for. A reviewer of the book suggested that Covell, who was then a professor of psychiatry and a practicing shrink, though a politically engaged one, would profit from reading Marx. Covell took up the reviewer's suggestion and was thoroughly transformed. Call me old-fashioned, but my intellectual sympathies still lie with that old Freudo-Marxist synthesis, and Joel is an adept practitioner. More recently, Covell became interested in ecological issues. He fell in with James O'Connor, the author of several excellent books with crisis in the title. But about 20 years ago, O'Connor founded a journal called Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, CNS, which is an attempt to bring together red and green, to bring Marxist political economy to bear on the ecological crisis and vice versa. While Marx said lots of things that prefigured modern environmental concerns, he was a creature of his time, and it was not front of mind, as they say in the management books. Many subsequent Marxists, especially those of the Soviet persuasion, loved heavy industry and just wanted to outproduce the capitalists. In fact, that was one of their criticisms of capitalism. It didn't produce enough, or wouldn't, once it entered its terminal crisis phase. In the early issues of the journal, the estimable O'Connor developed what he called the second contradiction of capitalism. The first contradiction involves overproduction. In their pursuit of profit, capitalists produce more than the market can bear. Workers whose pay is limited certainly can't buy all they can produce. This leads to periodic realization crises, as they say in the trade. That is, you can't sell what you produce, and therefore can't make money, and therefore can't make profit. The second contradiction refers to the propensity of capitalism to foul its nest, to undermine the natural environment which makes all production possible, and debases the workers in the society that keep its wheels turning. As O'Connor's health began to fade, he turned the editorship of CNS over to Covell in 2003. O'Connor, Covell, and company bring an intellectual seriousness to the work of political ecology that's often missing in other green analyses and movements, which can tend towards the moralizing, the sentimental, or the hysterical. Covell brings the issue his experience as a psychoanalyst. An important part of his work focuses on the mind that capitalism creates and selects for, a rapacious and imperious ego for which the accumulation of money substitutes for social and erotic pleasures. This is an important part of the ecological crisis because such a mind has a hard time seeing a problem, much less imagining a solution. Though this might sound abstract to practical sorts, if we're ever going to prevent ecological catastrophe, it's important to understand this dimension of the challenge. The first edition of Covell's book, The Enemy of Nature, came out late in 2001 and was eclipsed by post-9/11 insanity. Fortunately, an updated second edition came out recently from Zed Books. I open this interview, though, with some questions about his previous book, Overcoming Zionism. Joel Covell. Welcome, Joel. Before we get to The Enemy of Nature, I'm curious about the reception of your Zionism book. Norman Finkelstein is now writing a book in which he says that American Jews are gradually disengaging from Israel, politically and psychologically. Did you find anything of that sort in the reaction to the book?
I think it's the case. I mean, I don't agree with some of Norman's conclusions, but I think it's definitely the case, and I've seen it in my own speaking. I've spoken many, many times about the book, maybe 100 times in 15 months or so. And I've only had three really nasty confrontations with the audience. Now, what I did have, of course, was a very nasty confrontation with the lobby, which pressured the University of Michigan Press to get rid of the book and get rid of Pluto, who was the actual publisher, which they did, and in a stunning piece of cowardice and just opportunism of the worst sort. But once that happened, we were able to rally support and, got it restored, though the struggle goes on. But, the book has done remarkably well. What has happened is that there's been almost no surface attention to it. There's been no reviews in any, national publications, even on the left, so-called left publications. But it doesn't seem to have slowed down sales. It's all just moves along. It's in its third printing. And it's a testimony to the power of the internet and the alternative press and alternative media. I've spoken endless numbers of times as vast library of Joel Covell video clips on YouTube, which I'm sort of embarrassed to look at, but it's out there.
Well, it seems like the Zionist lobby is very aggressive now, policing the boundaries of respectable discourse, which suggests they're anxious. Is this really a symptom of anxiety?
Well, it's hard to tell because they're always that way. In the case of Zionism, it comes from a very deep core, stemming from the fundamental contradictions in logic. But in addition to that, there's no question that they're anxious, and you have plenty of signs of that. And the founding of this J Street, which is Soros funded, and but sort of liberal mainstream Zionists. One of the big turning points has to do with the Iraq War, where, despite efforts of denial, the case is absolutely clear that Israel, through the mediation of neocons and the Bush administration, played an enormous role in the whole nightmare. And that has caused big splits in ruling class circles. I think that's why Carter wrote his book. That's why Walton Mearsheimer wrote their book. I mean, that is to say, it's the return of liberal centrist, realist foreign policy mavens to the forefront because of what everybody feared would happen with Zionism, that the issue of divided loyalties and this other government, this other state, which is, after all, not us. I mean, I don't care for the nation state at all, but I mean, it exists, and one nation state is not another nation state, and there are boundaries, but these boundaries are scarcely respected, and because of the extensive, what I would call Zionification of the U.S., ruling elites, both in Congress and the executive and throughout civil society.
Well, let's turn then to the enemy of nature. The enemy of nature, of course, is capitalism. What exactly do you mean by capitalism? It's a big question to start with, but give us some sort of definition so we can have a roadmap for the rest of the conversation.
Capitalism is, to me, a form of a class society in which the extraction and generation of wealth depends on the exploitation of labor through production of surplus value. I have a fairly conventional Marxist treatment of the question of capitalism, and in my discussions of it, say in the book The Enemy of Nature, third and fourth chapters, I build on that and build on a passage in Marx's Capital and other writings where he points out that this involves a recentering of the logic of profit from the making of things to the exchange value inherent in the commodities. And Marx has these two circuits of circulation, where one goes from commodity to money to commodity prime, and the other goes from money to commodity to money prime, and capital represents the shift into that second system of circulation. And the reason I'm developing that is that Marx makes the point that the difference is that the original circuit, just as original class societies, feudal, aristocratic, and so on, were based on control of land or material things. Capital is based on control of money, of number, and as Marx points out very cogently, there's no limit to number. There's no limit to the expansion of value, and this expanding value beats up against the real limits of the material earth with its ecological balances. And the result is an endless contradiction where capital is constantly invading natural ecosystems and in its search for never-ending so-called growth or expansion. So that's, in brief, the capitalist system as I see it. It's a class society. It's based on exploitation, but the dimension of the exploitation shifts from use values to exchange values, from the control of land and resources to the control of money, which sweeps all of nature into its mouth, so to speak. And that's where we're at. The logic of capital accumulation involves shifts, as you would expect, to finance as the dominant modality by which capital regulates itself. You have the money markets, the stock markets, and all the futures markets, and all those things where players gather, and they're all subordinated to the terrible logic of growth. And in doing so, because capitalist production is a system inherently based on competition and ruthless dog-eat-dog logic, since it is the private ownership of the means of production, therefore each individual confronts all others in the marketplace as a maximizer. That process invariably plays into the transformation from use value to exchange value to produce this civilization of endless growth and endless conflict and consternation, and the growth drags nature along with it, and at some point passes the internal buffering capacities of, you know, planetary ecosystems in a very, very complex, unpredictable, chaotic way, shall we say, but inexorably. Keeps happening, and then you have all kinds of secondary effects. You have the 60 ecosystems that have been so affected, producing various kinds of positive feedback loops, interacting with each other. And so the system becomes ever more more chaotic. And that's my sentiments, but unfortunately, I think they're true, and it's bad news.
Several times you mentioned the centrality of money, and I think, you know, we certainly, as a society and as individuals, spend a lot of time thinking about money in some sense, yeah. But fantasizing about it, lusting after it, yeah. Trying to accumulate it. But most economists don't think money is a very interesting topic, for example. And we rarely think seriously about what money does to our minds. What does money do to the mind?
Woe unto them. I mean, there's always a temptation. And economics, because it is a quote-unquote science, to try and objectify things and to take it out of the domain of desire and the inner life. But, Marx had it brilliantly in the manuscripts and many others. You know, since, you know, money is basically the solvent of all fixed, fast, frozen relations, including those within the self itself, within ourselves. And so the self under capitalism is in a constant process of upheaval, and of course we understand some of that in a positive way, you know, the revolutions in personal life and individual autonomy, especially with the women of the better off classes living far better lives than their predecessors and so on. But what you have in general is I think of money as this universal solvent that destroys any notion of the sacred, destroys any notion of place that has a particular meaning. Now, what you then get in the real world is you get many, many reactions to that, that is to say, because one of my leading thinkers and leading thinker, Jim O'Connor, who founded the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, which I now edit, you know, the great transformation, Carl Polanyi, and pointed out very cogently that the transformation from the land-based and thing-based, you know, material-based, nature-based society to a money-based society is utterly destructive of society, and human civilization rapidly collapses if that just goes on its own. So what you get are then many, many secondary manifestations, and what the real effects in the actual human world are the product of these secondary manifestations. For instance, some of which take us greatly by surprise. For instance, when I was a lad growing up in Brooklyn, the ethos was advancing science. I was born in 1936, and so I grew up in a time when the great Grand Coulee Dam and all these things, these projects that was, you know, there was a tremendous prestige to science, and correspondingly a tremendous feeling that old religious beliefs would be torn up and wither away, you know, that we were passing into a post-faith-based society. And obviously that's proved to be a shockingly inaccurate rendition of the future, because quite the opposite has happened. I mean, if we look ahead back in 1944, 45, when I was going to public school and learning this kind of ethos, and say, well, there'll be a period, you know, half a century ahead when great religious wars rivaling those of the Middle Ages, or, you know, Crusades, or the 30 Years' War would be convulsing the world, and religious fundamentalisms would overtake virtually every religious belief, and we would have just laughed them out of court. And yet it is exactly what has happened. And I think that false prediction of a linear progress of science is exactly what we were talking about earlier. It overlooks the fact that money or capital, or the eternal destabilization that capitalist relations impose, destroy all sense of personal integrity or groundedness or bonds between people, or familial bonds or generational bonds, and is reacted to by terror, you know, terror and panic. And so then you get these I see the fundamentalisms, for instance, the, you know, the shocking growth of religious extremisms of all sorts as defensive mechanisms against the dissolving power of capital accumulation. So the stronger capital becomes globalized, the more it invades peripheral societies, the more it destroys all fixed, fast, frozen relations and so on, and particularly in the context of disempowering people, which is obviously what happens as imperialism has its way, and especially in the Middle East, you're going to get these kinds of reactions. These reactions are logically, through a negative kind of logic, are the reaction to the spread of the money-based, or to be more exact, capitalist economy. Because to just talk about money overlooks the power relations. It doesn't overlook the class relations. It overlooks the imperial fist that has to be militarized and put into action in order to gain these markets, to control these markets, to subordinate people to the logic of these markets and the like. So you have a civilization, not just a society, that is extremely chaotic in all of its forms. And this is one of the big arguments for the unsustainability of capitalism. That is, I make it in my book. I make it wherever I speak that we have a society both because of its ever widening differences between rich and poor, and also because of this basic dissolving mechanism of the money relation, which loosens desire, which creates addictions, which leads to an unmooring of the self, so to speak, that you have a civilization that is inherently not able to remedy, to remediate the ecological damage that it's doing. So you have this society breaking down ecologies all over the place, but also is not creating the kind of social relationships and the kind of individuals that can deal with it.
I'm speaking with Joel Covell, author of The Enemy of Nature, among other things, also editor of Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, a journal. And you write several times about capitalism's tendencies to overcome barriers. What look like barriers to accumulation only become challenges for new forms of accumulation. Why is that not the case in overcoming the ecological challenge? I can see how it would be absolutely impossible for capitalism to address the distribution of income. It just by its very essence creates poverty alongside wealth and rampant inequality. That is just so much part of the system that cannot be changed. But why is preserving the natural world the insuperable barrier?
Well, I think that on paper capitalism can do it, but it would involve a decline in growth, and capitalism cannot tolerate a decline in growth, and that's the rub. Maybe I can illustrate that with a very important article that's going to come out in Monthly Review in a few months by a young Chinese scholar named Min-Chi Li. He's an economist at the University of Utah. Academic. He was actually one of those run out of China after Tiananmen Square. He's part of the democratic movement there. So he presented this at the Historical Materialism Conference last weekend in Toronto. And it squares very much with my work in The Enemy of Nature, but it actually comes from within a more mainstream economic analysis of things. What he's done is just take the state of the art of climate science, both in terms of levels of atmospheric carbon and also in levels of changes in mean global temperature that might result, and combine them with the state-of-the-art economic predictions. And these predictions are obviously, to me, they're necromancy. I just as soon look at the entrails of a rabbit. Then you go, but maybe you can comment on the adequacy of these predictions. They say, if climatic CO2 goes from 380 parts per million to 450 parts per million, and if the mean global temperature goes to 2 degrees centigrade above where it is now, then such and such changes will occur in global growth, expansion of capital accumulation, however you want to conceive of that. So I don't know how they compute those things, but I do know that people spend a lot of time, money, and computer space computing these things. He came up with the following findings: that the only scenarios that would hold global climate change into any kind of potentially manageable, you know, scheme of things. That is to say, where ecosystemic interactions would not go haywire, which is what we're afraid of. The only scenarios which would be compatible, in other words, with survivability of civilization under the aegis of climate change, are those in which the economy would shrink, global economy would shrink, between 1 and 3%, depending. He analyzes 9 different scenarios. And that's an extremely important finding, because there's a great deal of wishful thinking on the part of the various ideologues of the system that everything can be managed, we can have the cake and eat it kind of thing. Having the cake or eating it means, in this sense, having an expanding system of accumulation, growth. You know, the mantra, are we growing or not? Is a rate of profit growing? Is there capital growing? Accumulation. And he says, no, that's not the case. It's just not going to happen. That the only conceivable scenarios, in which ecological damage can be kept under some kind of containment, control, mitigation is the buzzword there, are those where the economic product goes down in a serious way, and not, of course, in a momentary way. We're talking about a more or less, extended regime of negative economic growth for the planet. Now, as he cogently points out, I certainly agree. I don't know whether you agree with this, but that's incompatible with the logic of capital. Capitalist system cannot sit back and continue on the prolonged period of negative growth. So, in a way, that's a kind of an answer to the question you pose. Capital can do all sorts of things, but it can't do it and continue to expand. And why that is, I'm not even sure myself, because I don't know enough about economics. But it is, I think, inherently plausible. And the fact of the matter is, this is the state of the art. This is what the economists are working with now. Maybe there's another system of economics which will make it come out differently. But that's just fantasy. The real economics, the real climate science says that the only way we can have a habitable world is with an economic devolution of 2-3% of year after year, which to me means the collapse of capitalism. So that yes, capitalism is amazingly inventive. It's always climbed its way out of all of its accumulation crises, exactly. But the ecological crisis is not an accumulation crisis. It's the crisis which results if the accumulation crisis is being solved. It's even more complex than that, because if capital is going down, ecological crisis goes up, because there's a heightened effort to exploit, new zones of nature, new markets, new resources, and resource substitution, and like what like the issue with biofuels now, where they're trying to bring in, new kinds of putatively lower carbon fuel. Of course, that's not the case. It's actually higher carbon, but that's another story. So, the capital can continue to accumulate, but this is not an accumulation crisis. I mean, the ingenuity of capital was always in resolving its accumulation crises, which are principally, realization crises. The workers don't make enough to be able to buy their own products, and inventories build up and the like. And you know much more about that than I do. But this is a different kind of crisis, because as it's going down, there's a heightened rate of exploitation of nature, and as it's going up, there's by definition a heightened rate. Now, the answer is, well, why can't it do it? Why can't it do it? I think it can't do it because why can't it preserve ecosystemic integrity? I think because the profitability or the which translates into the accumulation of capital. Only results through the devaluation of nature. If you treat nature as an intrinsically good thing, in the logic of value, along with use value and exchange value, you also have intrinsic value. If you respect the intrinsic value of natural ecosystems, if you let things be, then you're not making money out of them. So my view is that in the very process of solving all these crises, capital only hastens the greater crisis, which is that of ecological collapse.
Well, since the venture capitalists see green technologies as their next big thing, we're going to get a pretty good real-world test of this in the coming years.
We're listening to an interview with Joel Covell, author of The Enemy of Nature, recently published by Zed Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, or online at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with more from Joel Covell. That was the beginning of the Ricercare, or fugue, for six voices from Bach's musical offering, as transformed by Anton Webern in 1935 and performed by Pierre Boulez conducting the Berlin Philharmonic. We'll hear the ending of that piece at the end of the show. And now, part two of my interview with Joel Covell, editor of the journal Capitalism, Nature, and Socialism, and author of the book The Enemy of Nature, published by Zed Books.
In the book, you speak of false needs, the desire for commodities. I think you've mentioned Coca-Cola and SUVs and things like that. Yes, it's be a very long list, 100,000 items at a Walmart, 600,000 on their website, right? But a lot of people feel those as very real needs. Who are you to declare them false?
Well, right. I mean false within the framework of ecocentric rationality. I mean, we're talking now about sort of kind of a philosophical anthropology. We are certainly part of nature, but we are that part of nature where nature's own transformation process becomes conscious and capable of direction. And again, going back to Marx, or simply just observing the logic of the economies, we all know that under capitalism, there's a constant rate of technological, innovation and automation and replacement of living labor with dead labor, so to speak, or past labor. And one of the mantras of capitalism is that, hooray, we're improving the productivity of the worker, and that means each worker makes more in less time. But since there is always that class difference, and as you pointed out, the iron logic of keeping the spreading poverty as well as wealth, you are going to always have an inability to consume everything you make, and you're going to have a constant pressure to make more and more, and you're going to have a constant massive and world-shaking effort to increase the consumption of commodities, which means fundamental changes in the human psyche. I talk about one of the logics of capitalism, civilization, is its destruction of faiths, and it's negative reaction to that in fundamentalism as well. Another is the constant creations of new zones of desire. And
is that entirely a bad thing? I mean, Ernest Mandel writes about the extension of needs under capitalism being a good thing, but the debasement of that through consumerism being the bad thing. Do you adhere to that distinction?
No, I don't. I mean, because that's you're faced with something you can't possibly define. I mean, extension of needs versus debasement of the consumerism. I don't. I think the whole word need. I mean, is a false one here. I mean, not false. It exists, but it's not the. It is not the. It's not what
my 2-year old is very fond of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he should be. But it's. I see the. Again, one of the problems with capital is that it dissolves the notion of human fulfillment or spiritual development, and partially replacing it with these barbaric, you know, religions that we. But I think that to me the needs, and I'm using the term I said we shouldn't use, but let's put it this way: that term should be defined in such a word that it, the way that it includes non-material needs as well as material needs. I mean, that is to say, we don't need more things. We need more connections. We need a richer inner life. You love music. I love you. I love your musical scores you play. Surely those, yes, capital has increased the capacity to spread music and to do the, you know, to put all kinds of musics together. That's fine. But the music itself is something where you can see human beings sort of going into it indefinitely without debasing nature. Bach spent 65 years going deeper and deeper into music. You know, he didn't have to become richer. He didn't have to become more, you know, overbearing. He wasn't a nice guy or anything like that, but that's because he's a human being. So there's a capacity. And when I say spiritual, I don't just mean, you know, some kind of new age, but just the capacity of the inner world or the imagination of human beings to grow and develop. That is for sure where we can move without debasing nature, okay? But it doesn't. And maybe what Mandel means is that consumerism destroys that process because it introduces commodities at every point rather than simply allowing that process to move ahead. But I don't see capital as the thing that the social formation that creates those capacities in human beings. I mean, because, I mean, human beings are certainly not more spiritually realized now. We're certainly not more, you know, I mean, have we gone beyond Mozart in the ability to think music? Of course not. But, you know, we have wonderful forms of music in the world, and it's great to see all kinds of world musics coming up, and that's nice. But I'm saying that there's a certain direction and dimension that human beings can develop where the inner world and the world of, in like an ecocentric way is in terms of harmony with nature or reaching out beyond the given natural world, but doing so in a spiritual way. I mean, you remember the old discussion from anthropology with Marshall Salins, the first affluent society. He talked about the Australian Aborigines and the poorest people in the history of the earth. They had, you know, virtually, you know, what kind of economy did they have? They had no money or anything like that. They had no state. But he said they got along fine on 4 hours a day of hunting and gathering and doing whatever they did. And the rest of the time, they spent making love, playing games, interpreting each other's dreams, and staring into the universe. I mean, none of which were ecologically devastating activities. And they did so. And these were fully developed human beings. You know, we can't go back to that degree because you and I are sitting here surrounded by, you know, thousands of generations of technological innovation and so on. But we certainly can keep that in mind. Einstein put it very, very well. He said, you know, the point about human beings, we start off in connection with the universe, and then we develop this ego, this form that isolates ourselves, but then we spend our lives reaching out beyond that form to the universe again, or can. To me, that's if you keep that in mind, then you have a way of thinking about, you know, a society beyond capitalism, a society beyond rapaciousness and the coarse materialism which comes with the money economy. So whether we'll ever get there is not clear and probably highly doubtful, but at least I think you can hold out that as a possibility.
Your goal is eco-socialism, but that compound contains the word socialism, a word you're not shy at all about using. No. You don't think it's irreparably damaged?
Of course not. I mean, it's just getting started. It took capitalism a long time to get started. It'll take socialism a long time to get started. I do think it's has to be a new mode of production. I think if we survive this period, they'll look back and say, well, you know, there was feudalism, and then capitalism replaced feudalism, and capitalism survived all of its economic crises, but eventually ran up against an ecological crisis that it could not master because of its compulsion to growth and the chaotic form of society. Humanity developed another way of producing life, which is still the and will always be so long as we're on the planet, the way we live. That's our human nature, is to produce ourselves and to create history and all the rest, and to create a spiritual world and, you know, music and whatever else we create. So we have to do so in a very definite way, and capital is, whatever I say about it, you know, I'm just one overriding fact that more and more people are coming to realize is that the capitalist system is doomed, is dooming us, is bankrupt. It will not solve these problems within its own terms. And we need to emerge from that with our creativity so that we can build another way of transforming nature, which to me has to be a socialist, in the sense that if we want to define what socialism is, and I tried to define capitalism before I go back to the Communist Manifesto, Marx writes, we shall have an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. And from a standpoint of economic history, that's a matter of undoing the separation of producers from the means of production, which is the essence of all of class society, obviously. And that has to be done in a vast and complex and variegated way, with many, many different forms appearing and gradually interconnecting with themselves. I think that it can be done. So I define eco-socialism as a socialism which is grounded, like all socialisms, on freely associated labor and has consciously ecocentric aims that that focus on the production of ecosystems instead of the production of commodities. And how to mediate those back and forth is a problem for the future, but I think you have to be aware that the only way out of this crisis is through that degree of transformation. And I think it's a race of how quickly people can realize that point. You know, the last years I have on life, on the earth, in my own life, will be spent in trying to just talking about that, writing about it, and bringing people to that awareness. I think people are more aware of it, and last year we founded something called the Eco-Socialist International Network. The listener can explore it on ecosocialistnetwork.org, and you know, we have it's a growing, very, very small, but nonetheless wide scope organization, not to develop the kind of eco-socialism that I talked about necessarily, but simply devoted to the premise that capitalism is bankrupt, that it is destroying the planet and destroying the future of humanity. We have to go beyond it. A post-capitalist society is a socialist society predicated on the freeing of labor, and that there has to be some kind of conscious ecocentric goal, and it can happen. I mean, I think that the question of needs has to be readdressed now. The needs now can be needs for what we would call ecological integrity, needs to build ecosystems of a certain kind in order to live. Or from another angle, eco-socialism is predicated on the defense of life, on the whatever that strange word means, and we have to explore that. We have to think of ways that we can live together so that life endures beyond this kind of nightmarish society that is, you know, destroying the planet.
I'll speak with Joel Covell, author of The Enemy of Nature. You're fairly critical of actually existing green movements and modes of thought, particularly the smallest beautiful, the bioregionalist, the localist. What's your problem with that breed of thinking?
Well, my problem is not that small is ugly or that we shouldn't live close to the earth and so on, but the problem is a kind of a fantasy that you can withdraw from the necessity of confronting the actual macroeconomy and the, you know, the capitalist system as a whole. I think that the term I use a lot is prefiguration. I think that the means that we use to overcome this crisis should contain the ends within them. The ends has to be a new kind of global society grounded in an approach for locality, but otherwise, if it's not the global society, if you don't see humanity as a, you know, universal kind of creature, then this kind of approach that sounds nice with small is beautiful, and if it's not mediated with a global or universal moment, you know, it becomes parochialism. It becomes you know, petty chauvinism. It can become racism. It can become all kinds of very narrow exclusivities. I mean, that we know from the history of humanity that there's innumerable effort, ways that people have retreated from the world into their little sects, into their little corners, into this cave and that cave, and small is beautiful, and it's like the retreat into fundamentalism. I mean, capitalism has built this planetary monster. We want to sort of retreat from it by building some kind of local integrity. We understand that, but if that's not mediated in a dialectical way with the sense of the whole of the whole planet, then we're going nowheres. So I think you have to have a political movement that is very much a dialectical, where you have, yes, indeed, local and small-grained and natural-centric, centric, whatever you want to call it, actions, but also, very widespread and global interventions. One of the best ways of grounding that is again, in the politics of dealing with climate change and the carbon regime, which is not the whole of the ecological crisis, to be sure, but certainly the most spectacular and most thoroughly studied and most politically fraught part. I mean, there's a great deal that can be done locally to build modes of sane appropriation of nature using energy in small-scale ways. And there's a great deal of very wonderful and powerful movements that can take place in the South, places like Nigeria, or Ecuador, Bolivia, where you have, indigenous peoples fighting against the intrusions of the petrol economy and the like. But in addition, I mean, you think you have to have activists taking on the global system itself, and for instance, the regime of climate protocols. I mean, just to be very focused for this moment, but focused at a very large scale, we have these Kyoto protocols that Al Gore played a big role in, initiating, that are utter disaster. People don't realize what a disaster Kyoto is, and they're a disaster for a very obvious reason, very evident, that it's giving capital control over the processes that it itself has engineered. It's the classic giving the hen house over to the fox. Now, Kyoto is expiring. It's expiring next year. In the next 18 months, there'll be the renegotiation of the Kyoto protocols coming together in Copenhagen. So after 2009, there'll be a Copenhagen protocols, and those will take effect in 2012 or something. Everything we know about climate change says we have a very narrow window here. And one thing the planet cannot afford to do is to sit around and allow capital to take the next round of climate protocols, which it wants to do. I mean, I've studied the website for the Copenhagen meetings. You can just check it out, Google it and follow it. There's all kinds of, progressive business associations that are organizing to make sure that the Copenhagen process gives results that are favorable to capital or business. What we need and can have, although it's very difficult, is a really worldwide movement against that. We have about 18 months. It'd be interesting because December of 2009, when this meeting in Copenhagen takes place, is 10 years after December 1999, when Seattle rebellions took place. We need a similar rebellion of that sort, but one that, and like Seattle, focuses on global capital, in that case the World Trade Organization, in this case the climate regime. It's the same beast, different side, and it can be done. So, but the small is beautiful, and the bioregional stuff does not contain within itself the moment that will look outside and take up the question of global capital and its drive to convert everything in the planet, including, of course, the atmosphere itself, into commodities. That has to be taken into account.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I'm still vague on the eco-socialist future. Who will sort and deliver the mail? Will there be post offices and mail trucks? Will there be mail at all? What energy sources? What kind of division of labor would prevail? You're kind of asking people to take a leap into the unknown, and it's not easy to get recruits for such a project.
Well, I'm asking people to face the real. I mean, that's to say, it's like if you yourself or one of us, anyone had a fatal illness, and yet there's a possible way of getting out of it. One should exert all possible measures to look into that. Each of those questions that you raise are real questions. Fortunately, we have, in an eco-socialist world, it's not an anti-technological world. It's not a world where we go back to some kind of Neolithic or Paleolithic way of being. I mean, there are ways of information transfer that are rather light on the earth, and you have to look for all of those ways that are light on the earth. You have to look for ways of bringing in the renewable energies, but in a way that is socialist and not capitalist. I mean, a friend of mine, David Schwartzman, has something in mind called solar communism. He's written about it in various journals, and he's convinced that solar energy can be gathered on a planetary scale if, however, a planetary scale to, propel civilization. If, however, the capitalist excrescences such as militarism and the false needs of the automobile industries and the like are dealt with. So these are all issues, they're all problems, they're all capable of being addressed. I can't possibly give you the blueprint for the future. I can only say, again with Marx, that ruthless criticism of everything existing is what we need, and if people are courageous to do that, out of that kind of process could emerge the beginnings in an authentic way of a new world beyond capitalism. That's all I can say. There's a lot of work going on all the time about that. People need to fight individually and at the place where problems are breaking out, but they also have to fight for the collective future of humanity as a species, which means, breaking with that logic of expropriation from nature and the destruction of nature that it has entailed. It can be done. Whether it will, I doubt I'll be around to see it, but it could still happen.
And that was Joel Covell, editor of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, and author of the book The Enemy of Nature, published by Zed Books. You can also check out his video, A Really Inconvenient Truth, the critique of Al Gore, a man Covell calls a false prophet, on the web at areallyinconvenienttruth.com. For more on the International Eco-Socialist Network he mentioned, see ecosocialistnetwork.org. I appreciate Covell's point about how you can't trust the capitalists to save the Earth, but on the other hand, I'm not sure we can wait for eco-socialist revolution to prevent climate catastrophe. I feel this point more pungently now that I have a 2-year-old. In any case, I like his idea about doing a rerun of Seattle and Copenhagen in a couple of years. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week to do some fundraising. Let's go out with the conclusion of Webern's version of Bach's Ricercate from the musical offering performed by Pierre Boulez, conducting the Berlin Philharmonic. Bye.